This is a regime that probably just killed 30,000 of its own people, including shooting people in hospitals.
Welcome to Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by The Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. I'm Eric Edelman, counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, non-resident fellow at the Miller Center, Bulwark contributor. I'm joined by my partner in all things strategery, Elliot Cohen, professor of strategy at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, emeritus, and an Atlantic contributor, and clearly someone with inside information, because he has absconded from the suddenly return of winter to Washington to the sunny climes of Florida. How is it down there, Elliot?
It's actually dark and soggy.
I feel better.
But it's less weird than Washington was, where we had one day in the mid-80s, and the next day I'm looking out my window, and by golly, it's a blizzard. It was bizarre. Listen, we need to get on to the jackasseries, because this has been a week filled with jackasseries. We can talk a little bit more about Steve Witkoff saying that, you know, when Putin says that he's not targeting information to the Iranians, he of course takes them at his word. He would do that. And Hegseth, Secretary of Defense, who calls himself Secretary of War, throwing out photographers from the Pentagon pool because they have been taking, quote, unflattering, unquote, pictures of him. But, you know, you and I have called those guys to account so many times that it feels like punching down. And that's not who we are this week. I mean, next week, you know, they don't get a free pass given how much jackassery they generate. I want to really sort of show a little bit of broad-mindedness. I want to look overseas. So my award for the jackassery of the week is actually the Bank of England, which has ordered a redesign of British banknotes. And they solicited all kinds of ideas because they wanted to have figures on the banknotes that would not be divisive. So that would mean killing off, and I kid you not, Winston Churchill, J.M.W. Turner, famous painter, Jane Austen, and Alan Turing, who, in addition to being a brilliant mathematician, was critically responsible for the breaking of German ciphers during World War II. And had, as many people know, a very difficult life because he was originally a closeted homosexual at a time when that was not what society would persecute you for that. So they were going to eliminate them because they would be divisive, like to have Jane Austen, let alone Winston Churchill. And it's, to me, this is just in addition to being jackassery, they're going to replace them with a hedgehog and other little furry creatures that you can find in what's left of the British countryside. And I have to say, this is to me one more symptom of the decline of Great Britain, a place which used to have this thing called the Royal Navy, which was, you know, at one point the greatest navy in the world, then just behind us, and now could not send a destroyer to Cyprus in time to protect it against Iranian missiles. So they had to rely on the French, the Greeks, and the Spanish, who they last defeated in the time of Queen Elizabeth.
So you're telling me Britannia no longer rules the waves?
Britannia has lost the plot.
Well, I'm going to stick to the Trump administration. Although I agree with you, we've picked on Witkoff and Hegseth enough. So I will pick on two other cabinet members, actually. One, Energy Secretary Chris Wright, who, in the midst of what the International Energy Agency has described as the most serious and biggest disruption of energy supplies ever, decided that he would send out a tweet that indicated that a ship carrying oil had transited the Strait of Hormuz and been escorted by U.S. Navy ships. This created enormous ruction in the market. You know, the price of oil dropped dramatically. I'm dying to know who knew about this and was placing bets on oil futures. But only to have that tweet taken down a couple of hours later. And, you know, it appears, and this is a frequent occurrence, so in the Trump administration anyway, so I don't know what to make of it, but it was the work of an errant intern. And now Secretary Wright, in the midst of this incredible energy crisis, is personally reviewing all social media from the Department of Energy before it goes out, which is just what we want him doing, I'm sure. The other kind of, just attractive nuisance that we have to notice is the president's apparent not only fascination, but his obsession with Florsheim shoes, Oxford wingtip types, which he has found so comfortable and so wonderful. They're American-made products, that he has taken to guessing the shoe size of his cabinet officials and then ordering multiple pairs for them, which it turns out they are then afraid, according to White House insiders, not to be seen wearing in the presence of the president, which has led, of course, Secretary of State and National Security Advisor Marco Rubio to appear in several pictures in a pair of shoes, obviously two sizes too big for him. We're really in death of Stalin territory here, you know, as our colleague on the Bulwark, Kathy Young, has noticed in her account of all this. And it's just where we are.
All I can say is I just hope none of those cabinet secretaries have bunions, because it's not that comfortable wearing those kinds of shoes if you do. And there are perfectly good American-made solutions to that problem, but I guess the president seems to be fixated on Florsheim. Now, some of this stuff you cannot make up, although maybe we can use this as a segue to the more serious part of our discussion, which is, there is so much about the administration that is ridiculous, so much that's dangerous, so much that's illegal and problematic, so much that is, chaotic, that at one level, I think it's understandable how that has spilled over into the coverage of the Iran war, where, the drift of, I guess we used to call it mainstream media, is uniformly critical. And, 3 days in, you're talking about a quagmire, and or you're, fixated on this awful incident where a girls' school got hit in Iran. And the overwhelming coverage, I think, it's fair to say, is negative. But the problem with that is, there are two huge problems with that, I feel. One is it gets in the way of an attempt to understand as objectively as one can what's actually happening on the ground. And the second thing, which is actually, I think, closer to moral turpitude, is failure to wrestle with what the Iranian regime is. And for me, that's actually the part that I find that even more troubling than the first part. If you'll let me just riff on that for a moment. So a couple of years ago, I gave a lecture at Chautauqua, a beautiful resort up in northern New York. And on that stage, a couple of weeks later, a Islamist fanatic drove a knife into Salman Rushdie's eye. And it reminded people that, this was indirectly triggered by the fact that the Iranian regime issued a fatwa calling for his death wherever he was. And, he had to spend years literally in hiding and under protection. And the failure of reporters and analysts and commentators to focus on the fact this is a regime that probably just killed 30,000 of its own people, including shooting people in hospitals, torturing people, hanging people from cranes, deliberately the judges, arranging the nooses themselves, so that you have a long, miserable death by strangulation, that has had a history of utterly unremitting, unqualified hatred of the United States and with Israel, the stated desire to destroy it, which means like extermination. And that somehow, and that clearly was also making a is making a dash for a bomb and is arming itself to the teeth. And the failure to talk about that, it drives me crazy because I don't like giving President Trump credit for much. But the truth is on his side when he said, you know, other presidents kind of admired the problem. They tried different things, a little bit of force, a lot of negotiation, to some extent looking the other way. And he's actually trying to resolve it in a very direct and violent way. That's you and I will dissect the operation in a moment. But that's been sort of the dominant thought in, or thoughts in my mind this week.
Look, I think those are all fair observations. I think in the defense of the commentariat, I would say, and this may not be much of a defense, but in the first instance, there are very few journalists today who actually understand anything about military and military operations. I mean, at CSBA, we try to remedy that by doing a seminar for journalists to try and just acquaint them with fundamentals of, you know, defense. So there's a lot of ignorance. Now, that's not true of people like Eric Schmidt and Greg Jaffe at the New York Times. I mean, they're obviously exceptions to that. And so you do get some very good coverage. I would say there's the military coverage of the New York Times, I think, has actually been pretty good. But
Michael Gordon at the Wall Street Journal.
Right. There, Michael Gordon at the Journal there, and there's some others, you know, so there's, I think that's one point. The other point I think is kind of to be a little bit, you know, to give some of the others the benefit of the doubt, the administration did almost nothing to prepare the public for this, including the media, which is different from, you know, previous efforts like the Gulf War, where we embedded journalists, took them with the same in OIF, et cetera. And the administration has been all over the map explaining what it is it's doing, you know, why the president decided to do what you said, which is to solve the problem violently and do it now. I mean, is it about the nuclear program? Is it about the, which he said he had obliterated? Is it about the ballistic missile program? You know, is it about the Navy? I mean, they keep talking about they destroyed the Navy. Although the Artesh Navy, the regular Navy, is actually not the issue we're wrestling with now, which you and I are, I think, going to get into in a minute or two here. But so there's been this ever-shifting kind of rationale for why the action was undertaken. And of course, the public hasn't been prepared for, or the Congress. I mean, so there's, to the extent that there is confusion about all this and lack of focus on the regime, some of that, I believe, is the administration's own fault.
I absolutely agree with that. I think, you know, in terms of war leadership, failing to attend to domestic public opinion, that there is the constitutional issue of consulting with Congress, trying to get them on board. Absolutely. You know, failing to give that speech from behind the Resolute desks that explains to the American people what you're up to. Absolutely. However, here's what I would say on the other side. I think the tone is essentially no different from the commentariat than it was for the 2003 Iraq War, because it was the same basic attitude towards the administration, which was an assumption of bad faith, which, you know, you might say, well, it's warranted in this case, wasn't warranted in that case. And I would probably agree with you, but I think this is,
right,
you know, this is something now that we've seen for a while. And part of this is simply in the kind of social media age that we're in. If a war isn't wrapped up in a week, we think it's interminable. And, you know, the fact, and this is just speaking as a military historian, wars usually go on for a long time. There's really back and forth. The other guy does do things that surprise you. That always
of course
happens.
Right.
And so they, you know, the kind of insane impatience about it, I think is part of it. I think the other explanation, by the way, is I don't think Trump himself, who's not a thoughtful or reflective man in the slightest, the experiences of the use of military power that he's had taught him that he doesn't have to do this, killing Soleimani, even the going after the Houthis, which was a long, you know, that was a campaign that lasted a lot longer. But for some reason, it wasn't as salient because, you know, you didn't have the issue of oil. You know, the Venezuela operation, these were all kind of by and large in and out or just not particularly visible. This is very visible. And he just didn't think it through. And, you know, I guess the last thing I'd say is, as you and I have discussed many times, it's pretty clear these guys don't have a real foreign policy process, you know, which is what you would normally want to have, where you have an NSC that is, you know, helping to draft the talking points so that everybody's on the same page, and so forth. But still, at the end of the day, I mean, I read a lot of the commentary, and I seriously, even people I know, I sometimes feel like asking, you know, are you really rooting for the other guys to win? Because that's not where you ought to be.
Right. So, you know, the other point I would make here is the administration's not served itself very well. Again, I think by the incredibly limited amount of information that it's put out. I mean, you know, if you go to the, dare I say it, the Department of War website, it's obviously the DOD website, which has now been renamed the Department of War. I refuse to accept that until the Congress has actually, you know, done it by statute, which is the requirement. But I know that's a quaint, you know, adherence to the rule of law. But I guess, you know, there, I don't know exactly why this is, you know, and who's ordained this, but you don't even get a daily operational, you know, update from CENTCOM. You know, they're doing it every couple of days, and it's a slide or two slides. And it basically says, we've used the following platforms, you know, and capabilities we can't tell you about. And it makes it very difficult to, you know, I think even for, you know, pretty informed observers like you and me to actually follow what's going on. And I think it makes it much tougher, you know, for people less well educated or informed and much less, you know, your average American citizen who's got a lot of other things on their mind. So I you know, again, a lot of this, it seems to me, has been, I don't want to excuse, you know, some of the derelictions of the press here. But I do think, you know, to understand it, there's a bigger context. And I guess I would say that as time has gone on, I'm increasingly troubled by, you know, the operational success is not arguable. I mean, they've obviously done remarkable things. You've drawn attention correctly to the fact that the Israelis are carrying a huge share of the load here. I mean, I think Secretary Hegseth said today they've hit 15,000 targets. You know, General Kane said the U.S. military's hit 6,000 of those targets. So it means that the Israelis have hit 9,000. So there's a you know, a tremendous amount of work being done here by Israel. The Israelis seem to be doing a lot. You know, if you're concerned about the death of the regime, the Israelis are doing a lot to hit targets that are related to internal security, which we are not doing very much of. But I guess there's some things that have transpired in all this that are now giving me a lot of pause about where this is going and how you answer the question that Linda Robinson famously put to Dave Petraeus about the you know, 2003 invasion of Iraq and OIF, which is, you know, how is this going to end exactly?
So let me get to that in a second, but just, I think, to wrap up the commentary part of that, I completely agree, self-inflicted wound. You know, the model was in some ways the first Gulf War when, if you remember, Norman Schwarzkopf, after going through a couple of completely inept spokesmen, he got Brigadier General Butch Neal, this young Marine general from Boston, I'm glad to say, who did a wonderful job of briefing the press. And I think they understood that it's important to engage the press. That was a painfully learned lesson. I think that said, you know, it is always a temptation for military people to say, oh, we don't want to have those guys here. And of course, Hegseth is just such a toxic kind of personality, and really all he can do is kind of strut and snarl, is completely incapable of engaging the press in a respectful way, let alone a, you know, just a serious way. He can't even be courteous. So I completely agree. That's very destructive. One other thing, though, this isn't just the journalists. You know, you now have there's a think tank world. There are these other sort of quote unquote expert worlds. So there's a torrent of commentary that floods the airwaves and, you know, print or electronic media and, you know, social media and so forth. And that's why you have to be prepared to fight on that ground, which these guys are not. But that said, that doesn't excuse, you know, people like us or professors or what have you, from being responsible in how they try to assess an ongoing war. But let's talk about the substance. I'm going to begin with that famous David Petraeus question, which is in one ways a right question. It is not a question that can usually be answered at the very beginning of a war. You know, you helped me improve considerably my forthcoming book on strategy. And, you know, you'll recall that I do this exegesis of these memoranda that Churchill, a master strategist, if ever there was one, writes as he's sailing over the Atlantic to meet with Franklin Delano Roosevelt after Pearl Harbor. And, it, you know, as you'll remember, I kind of take it apart, said there's some things he anticipates about how the war's going to end and other things completely misses. So, I think one of the mistakes that people make when they talk about a war is to say, if you don't have a very precise plan for how the war comes to an end, you don't have strategy. And that's not true for a bunch of reasons.
Look, I agree with that. And, you know, one of my very distinguished predecessors as Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, the late Freddie Clay, in fact, wrote a whole book.
Wonderful book.
Which basically made the argument that the exertion of getting governments into war is usually so great that it, by and large, you know, kind of chases out a whole lot of, you know, deliberate and careful thought about, you know, how the war will end. The book is called Every War Must End, and it is still in print, Columbia University Press, for folks who want to read it. And so I take the point. However, as you point out, there's got to be a theory of victory. And it's not clear what the theory of victory is here. I mean, I think you and I would say victory would be the regime is gone at the end of this. But I'm increasingly worried that we're going to not have the regime gone. And I'm worried that we're going to, the president, I think, is now kind of caught between kind of the Scylla and Charybdis of mission creep, right? Which is he ends up getting into a much longer protracted war where there's land operation, boots on the ground. That's very perilous for him politically. And then the other, you know, side of the dilemma is getting out too soon.
Yeah.
Before we've accomplished, you know, lasting objectives. The Secretary of Defense was saying today their missile capability is destroyed. You know, their Navy is destroyed. I don't think the Navy was really the big challenge. Their nuclear program, you know, is gone. Well, number one, you know, the missile capability has clearly been degraded, but they're still firing. And the number of launchers I've noticed that have been disabled, that number, you know, the still extant missile launcher number that the Israelis are briefing periodically, that stayed about the same for the last 4 or 5 days. It's like 150. And so can they reconstitute that? The drone capability. Okay. They've hit a lot of the drone assembly facilities. That's good. But the Iranians may have, I don't know, 10,000 drones. They've only fired like 2,000. And they have a very ramified, you know, supply chain of smaller enterprises that are making the components that are assembled in the drone factory. So that strikes me as something, as a capability that can be much more easily reconstituted once the, you know, hostilities stop. And that's what they've been using to inflict the most damage on the region. So anyway, help me on this.
Well, let's first start with the objectives that they described of, if not destroying in the sense of totally eliminating, but very, very severely damaging three key things. One is the naval piece. One is the ballistic missile / drone piece. And the other is the nuclear piece. And, you know, the problem is we don't know. I mean, we don't know how many underground arsenals have been blown up. We don't know how many factories have been destroyed. We don't know how many key people have been killed. But, you know, I guess I tend to assume that a fair amount of damage has been done. And then the fourth thing is clearly doing a lot of damage to the core regime repressive elements. So the question is, what is victory? Everybody, understandably, and this was Trump's mistake, glommed on to the idea that the only definition of victory in this conflict is if there's a revolt and the Iranian people rise up and you get a liberal democracy. Not entirely inconceivable, but probably never very likely given the extent of the repressive apparatus. That doesn't mean, though, that you haven't had a lot of very substantial success in regard to all four areas. You know, I suppose at the minimum you say, well, to some extent, this is another mowing the grass kind of operation, and maybe that's what it is. That is to say, you're doing something that's going to limit the threat. But I think there's another part to this as well, which is much longer term. And again, we won't really know. But if, let's say, you know, this will come to an end at some point. Who knows exactly how, but people will stop shooting at each other. You know, you're going to have a broken-backed Iranian regime. It may still be around. It'll be a lot poorer. It'll be a lot weaker. It will have lost a lot of its key people. It will no longer have a supreme leader who everybody respects, and who knows, may not even be his son, who, you know, the reports are different about how badly he was hurt. And of course, you know, we and the Israelis are looking for him. So, you know, what you might have 6 months from now, or even a year from now, or 2 years from now, as a result of the war, might be a better kind of Iran. There is a contradiction, by the way, in some of the arguments I've heard, which is, well, there's, you know, you can't do anything because the regime is just so deeply institutionalized that you can't break its grip. But then in almost the same breath, people say, and if you ever did, you'll have chaos. Well, if it's that deeply institutionalized, you're not going to get chaos.
I mean,
and we can argue about what chaos means.
Yeah, well. I mean, but I think, you know, the potential here also is, you know, the president loses interest. I mean, he's very sensitive to oil prices. Right? When it hit $120 a barrel, he came right out and said, oh, we're ending this in a week. You know, everyone calm down. They're doing a lot of stuff to actually manipulate the market. Including, you know, when we were talking about the jackassery, I don't rule out that Chris Wright was consciously trying to manipulate the market when he put out that video. This gets to some of the things that, you know, for all the technical skill that, you know, our military has demonstrated and the Israeli military have demonstrated, that there are some things that are downright, you know, inexplicable in the degree that they appear to have been unanticipated, at least by the political leadership and maybe by some on the military side. One we've talked about in the previous, you know, I think episodes of Shield of the Republic, which is the failure to deploy significant counter-drone defense technologies, even after all the experience of the war in Ukraine. I think there was a lot of, despite the fact that the Pentagon has had innumerable, multiple studies of lessons learned and, you know, efforts to develop counter-drone technology. Lloyd Austin signed a big counter-drone, you know, directive pretty much right before he left office. But the services themselves have just not taken this on board and certainly haven't procured things that, you know, have adequately protected our bases and forces out there. It seems like a huge oversight. But I mean, I'm absolutely stunned that it was, 10 days into the operation before they apparently hit the mine storage facilities with regard to the Strait of Hormuz and the Gulf, when it was pretty clear that this was going to be an Iranian strategy to try and clamp down, shut down the Gulf, create economic dislocation and in the West and impose enormous costs on Trump politically and economically, and not just Trump, but on their neighbors and on the global economy. And then finally, the expenditure of munitions, particularly high-end munitions, that we've just been burning through. This was predictable. I mean, our shortfalls in munitions are something that, a number of us have been screaming about for some time. Something we raised in the National Defense Strategy Commission report a year and a half ago. And although there's been a lot of money appropriated to increase munitions production, here we are to a point where I worry a little bit that we're leaving ourselves a little bit naked to our enemies, in other theaters. So all of those things are, and then when you add to that, I agree with you that you can't expect a war to start with, people have a plan for how the war ends, because the enemy gets a vote, as the old saw goes, and war is nonlinear, and you don't know what twists and turns it's going to take. But even the deficiencies you identified in Churchill's memos, were wrapped up in arguments that were much closer to the mark about what needed to be done in order to win and to be able to define victory. And I just don't see that here.
So, all right. I mean, as usually is the case, we're about 85 to 90% in agreement, but only up to a point.
Lord Copper.
First thing, in general, I think people to get locked into certain technologies. So one of the things about those Churchill memos, I do hope this will sell more books, is Churchill is fixated on the number of battleships
right. That
they have. And this is even, after the Japanese just sent a whole bunch of American battleships to the
Pearl Harbor,
and as well the Prince of Wales and the Repulse later on. I think Dave Petraeus and others, I think this is now sort of a bit of a cliche, but it's nonetheless correct. There's a difference between lessons identified and lessons learned. You can identify the lessons just fine, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you've really adapted to them.
Right.
I think the American military, in the same way the American military, was actually fairly slow to go into the drone business and the unmanned aerial system business, wanting very typically to go to the high end, when the Israelis actually start out at the low end. I mean, that's true about drones. It's also true about mine warfare. The Navy has never really liked mine warfare at all.
Oh, right.
And that's something you leave for the Danes. So I think there should be an accounting for the services. On the production of munitions, absolutely. But that is a sin that goes way, way back.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, yeah.
And Congress is culpable in this. Democrats, Republicans, like everybody. Nobody has wanted to say we're going to have multi-year procurement so that, the Boeings or Raytheons know that they can build an additional factory. Nobody's really willing to say, look, we're going to have duplicative capabilities. So we'll have two factories running at 50% instead of one running at 100%, that sort of thing. On the hitting the mine storage, that, you know, as with so many of these things, I want to know more. In my last article I did in The Atlantic, I did say one of the things that is characteristic of air power types and air power planners is they do tend to think of strategy as a target deck. You know, we've got 10,000 targets, and victory is when you work your way through the targets. That doesn't leave a whole lot of room for operational art and, you know, that sort of thing. That said, my guess is the overwhelming focus in the first days of the operation was the Iranian air defense system, which has had a lot of success. We're now flying B-52s, these ancient aircraft that are over 60 years old. We're flying those over Iran. You never would have done that if there was any kind of air defense left. And you know, the U.S. Air Force is obsessive about this. I remember when we went into Afghanistan, what are the first two targets that get hit? I think it was two MiG-17s. So these are like late 50s, early 60s Soviet interceptors that probably couldn't even fly in Bagram. But you bet those were the first two things the Air Force took out. I think they started with that, and then probably what they went after were the ballistic missiles, because those were the most direct threat to us, but also to our allies. So, you know, that might explain it. On the question of munitions, I mean, the best way to drive down the need for sophisticated munitions is going after the launchers,
right?
Going after the ballistic missiles, which they seem to have been doing, and they seem to have. They've certainly suppressed the launch rate.
And much better than we did, you know, say in the first Gulf War when you did the Gulf War air survey for the Air Force.
Right. And you know, and so now my understanding is most of the munitions are being dropped are, you know, dumb bombs with guidance kits. And those, you know, those include glide bombs of different kinds. And those are quite cheap. But here's the thing that I want to throw back at you and get your response. The one thing that I have yet to hear anybody talk about is, okay, so what was the alternative? I mean, you had an Iran that it looks to me was racing to see if it can build a nuclear weapon. That I don't know when they made that decision, but I tend to think that is what they were doing. And they're clearly getting to the point where they could put one together in very, very short order at the bare minimum. Do we just let them do that? It was also clear that they've been successfully building a very large ballistic missile inventory, and that was going to be one of such a size that it would overwhelm any defense that not just the Israelis, but that anybody could put up against them. So the question is, I mean, were you going to negotiate them out of that? I don't think so. Were you going to turn it into a peaceful regime? I don't see how you could. Were you going to be able to mass produce the interceptors to take down waves of hundreds of ballistic missiles? I don't think that's feasible either. So what are you going to do? Just wait until this happens?
No, that's a fair question. And I'm not sure I have a great answer to it. I mean, the ballistic missile problem, I think, was in fact the more urgent one. If there's evidence that they were moving towards a bomb, I haven't seen it. And it'd be good for the administration to bring it forward. I mean, yes, they had gone a long way towards, enriching uranium to the point where they could very quickly have enough fissile material for a bomb. They clearly had been working on testing, you know, designs for a warhead, explosive experiments, et cetera. But since June, I haven't seen much evidence that they were trying to rebuild the SPND building, the headquarters of the nuclear program, which got flattened in the early hours of this operation. There hasn't been much striking of other targets, though, on the nuclear side by either us or the Israelis.
As far as we know.
I mean, I think they finally hit, it looks like they hit, based on some publicly available satellite imagery, the high explosives facility at Talagan 2 in Parchin in the IRGC compound And there were some other targets in that compound hit as well. And maybe, maybe one or two strikes at Natanz. But Pickaxe Mountain, which would be presumably the place you'd be most concerned about, hasn't been hit at all yet. Now, maybe they're planning to do that later in the campaign. I don't know. But, I mean, if the nuclear piece was the most urgent, you would think after neutralizing the, you know, I mean, we're like 12, 13 days into this now. They, you know, the air defenses were pretty well knocked out in the first, 48 hours. Ballistic missiles, they pretty well degraded. I mean, it's interesting because the curve has kind of gone flat on how much, as I said, they're getting after the launchers. So you'd think they'd go after some more of the nuclear targets. I don't know. Look, I for a long time, my view has been that the only ultimate solution to the problem placed by Iran is regime change, that as long as that regime is there, you can't. But I'm not sure a military campaign is actually the right way to get after it. I think the thing we've neglected to do, and this is, again, plenty of blame to go around, it goes back, through multiple administrations, has been to have a serious covert effort to try and bring the regime down. We've never done it. We've never been serious about aiding the opposition, helping them, doing the kinds of things we did in the Cold War with Poland or other places. That seems to me to have been one of the big missing elements in our statecraft when it came to Iran.
Well, I mean, ideally, I would say you would want to be doing both, because I can't really imagine either one succeeding on its own. And there's a third element, too, which is the public diplomacy, information, warfare side of this. And of course, there the administration decided to not only shoot itself in one foot, but to shoot itself in both feet by putting the utterly incompetent Kerry Lake in charge of Voice of America with the mission to destroy it, which she's done her best to do, even though the courts keep on stopping her. But I mean, for me, the central point here is Iran is really a serious problem. You don't want to look on the nuclear question. You don't want to wait until they actually do decide.
No, I agree.
I actually completely understand why, if you would prioritize first air defenses, then ballistic missiles, then the maritime capacity part of it, because they're not going to be able to move most of the nuclear stuff, certainly not while you're watching, in a way that works for them. So, you'll work over those targets. I just want to say on can I get back to Trump for a moment? Because
You do, let me just say that, Midnight Hammer, you and I were in total agreement. There was not much argument, against doing Midnight Hammer. And it was, I think, extremely successful. And I think our initial judgments about that have been vindicated by what's happened since. There's a point here, which is and this is a very Churchillian point, allowing gathering dangers to grow without taking action is very easy for governments to do, and it's what they do most of the time. It always is more costly to wait, and the longer you wait, the more costly it is. So taking out that program 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago would have been a lot, easier and less costly. There are good and sufficient reasons why we didn't, but there you go.
Or even, being, really openly acknowledging what the Iranians were doing to us. I mean, we don't have to rehash this, but, you and I are both going crazy when the Iranians, who have been responsible for the deaths of a lot of American kids.
Yeah.
And people didn't want to lay a finger on them.
Right.
They didn't want to lay a finger.
I remember I still have scars.
I know. Before we move on to one or two other things, could we just talk a little bit about how do you think this thing looks 1-2 years out? So just to open the bidding, I'd say first, who knows with Trump? He's volatile, chaotic. But I think somehow on this one, he's not simply going to declare victory and go home. He may very well do that. He's capable of anything. But I think this has touched something more deep in him And it's caused a lot of people to underestimate him. I mean, remember how many people were absolutely certain that he wouldn't do Midnight Hammer? Well, he did it. Or that if he did this thing, it would be a couple of days, and then he gives up. So I think there, you know, he has surprised me now enough times that I'm careful about making any predictions about his behavior. But as you look at this 1 or 2 years out from where we are, what do you think we're going to see?
Well, I can only tell you what my, you know, what I'm fearing we're going to see, which is that, you know, whether this goes for a few more weeks or, you know, maybe even a couple of months, whatever it is, it will end up with a wounded regime still in place, very much diminished in its military capabilities, but still there and licking its wounds and trying to the best it, you know, can to rebuild its asymmetric capabilities and to go back to its calling card, which is terrorism. And that we will see an upsurge of terrorism driven by Iran. I mean, the fact that we've had two incidents in the United States in just the last 24 hours is, you know, ought to already be a cause of concern, both at ODU here in Virginia, but also in Michigan. That's my fear.
Also in Europe and in Canada.
Yeah, in Europe and right.
And most of these take the form of attacks on
synagogues
and other Jewish sites, which again, calling card of the Iranian regime, right. Which people need to be reminded of, including that the horrific Amia attacks
in Buenos Aires.
So. Here's, I guess, maybe I'm being willfully optimistic. It seems to me here are some of the long run.
Khobar Towers is another.
Khobar Towers, absolutely. Here are, not to mention everything with Hezbollah, the attack on our embassy there. You know, these all had Iranian fingerprints all over them.
Yeah,
and I think it's really important to remind people this regime has been implacably, murderously hostile to the United States from day one.
They killed more Americans through terrorism than any other source before 9/11.
Right. So this, and it's baked into, this is the DNA of the regime. So I guess here's my take. First is much militarily a much, much weaker regime. I don't see that they're going to be able to rebuild their air defenses anytime soon. The Russians have their own problems. I think, if we look around, the Gulf states, even if they feel they have to in some ways make terms with them in some way, I think have to be concluding that this is really a mad dog regime. That they did their level best to stay out of this. They did not participate in the attacks. They didn't, probably with some exceptions, didn't give us basing. And they still ended up sucking up drones and ballistic missiles aimed at their cities, at desalination plants, at airports. So I think the international environment that the Iranians have just created for themselves is...
Cloud computing centers.
Yeah, I mean,
it's a lot of economic targets. LNG facility, the whole nine yards.
And you know, this Norman Rule was making that point in our discussion with him, if you remember, that they're going to remember this. And so that's one bad thing for them. In the short run, this is good for Putin in terms of oil revenue. I think in the long run, it's not good for him for two reasons. One, it shows that he cannot and will not attempt to bail you out if you're a partner of his. I think the Chinese, there's something similar. Well, I think the other thing is, you know, it's clear that the Ukrainians now have several teams on the ground in the UAE. You know, one of the great stories in the Russia-Ukraine war is the Ukrainian defense industry. And I am willing to bet that hundreds of millions of dollars, if not billions of dollars, of Gulf oil money is going to end up being invested in those defense industries. And that's going to be a very powerful combination. Because, you know, actually, Mick Ryan had a very good piece about this. I think, I forget which Ukrainian brigade conducted the first offensive operations entirely with unmanned systems. And there's going to be more and more of that. And the Ukrainians, actually, Dave Petraeus has been going around saying this as well. The Ukrainians are ahead of everybody in terms of thinking about this new era of warfare. So, you know, they've just gotten a plus, you know, shown that they do have cards to play. I think in terms of the American reputation, particularly Trump's reputation, since he'll never say this was a terrible mistake, is you have a guy in charge who will use force in a very, very substantial way. And let's face it, that'll make some people unhappy, but it's that can have a salutary effect on others. I mean, I think if I were Chinese, it might be, you know, the accounts might be saying, well, they have so many fewer than you thought. But you know, a political leader will think, yeah, but this is a crazy guy, and he's a guy who's willing to use a lot of violence. Just one last thing I would say is, and I think if when you fight a war that really devastates your country, the political reckoning doesn't necessarily come at once.
Sure,
it can come months, years. Sometimes quite a few years later. Sorry.
Go ahead. Right. In fact, I think a lot of Israeli intelligence types who follow Iran are saying precisely that the regime's not going to collapse now. It's probably going to be a year or year and a half, maybe two, before this all comes to fruition. And, you know, we'll see. I guess, I mean, look, those are all valid points. I take them all. A couple of counterpoints. One, so on the Chinese, Trump clearly had them very discomforted in the first Trump term. They had trouble reading him and predicting him. And so his unpredictability is an asset when it comes to managing China, no question. By the same token, you know, we know that Iranian ghost fleet ships are actually escaping the Gulf and headed to China. Why aren't we seizing those?
Man, you know, good point.
I mean, we've been doing that, you know, we did that in the Caribbean and the Atlantic. Why aren't we doing it in this instance? I don't know the answer. My suspicion is Trump doesn't want to, you know, do that, you know, before he meets with Xi next month. So, you know, there's mitigating factors. On Putin, I agree with what you say about the potential long-term implications for investment in Ukrainian defense industry, et cetera. But I would point out that, not only is Putin benefiting from higher oil prices right now, and, you know, who knows how long that'll last, you know, hopefully not terribly long, although it could end up being quite long, depending on how this all plays out. But he's also now being, you know, relieved of a lot of sanctions, supposedly temporarily. You know, I'm not sure how temporary that sanctions relief will be in this administration, certainly under Trump. I mean, Kirill Dmitriev just was meeting with Witkoff and Kushner in Miami again. And, you know, every time that happens, it seems like there's some kind of, you know, sugar plum fairy, you know, economic deals, you know, dancing in the eyes of our amateur diplomat negotiators. And the president just yesterday, I think, or today, was asked about, you know, Ukrainian assistance on counter drones. He says, we don't need any help from them. We have the best drones in the world. And he's been slagging Zelensky relentlessly in the last week for reasons that, you know, I'm trying to figure out what is it that Zelensky did other than prove that the president was wrong and that he does have some cards.
Precisely.
I mean, but that's not a good thing. I mean, the fact that that's the president's reaction. So, we've we're going to go a little over time here because there's a, you know, a couple more things to unpack. If the president loses interest in this and turns his attention away from this, I suspect it'll be because he decides this is too hard, but there's an easier target out there that he can turn to, which is Cuba. I mean, the regime in Cuba is really in, you know, bad shape. I mean, ideally, I think in Trump's own mind, what he thinks is, I'm going to go down as the president took care of Maduro. You know, that was a 20-year problem. You know, I'm going to take care of the Ayatollahs. That's a 40-year problem. I'm going to take care of the Castro brothers. That's been a 60-year problem. No other American president had the balls to do all this. And that's, you know, that's what I'm going to do. So, I mean, I think Cuba is, you know, they're obviously, you know, the president, Diaz-Canel, has just, you know, confirmed, both the Miami Herald and New York Times are reporting that there are negotiations, discussions going on with the administration. You know, Marco Rubio allegedly has been talking with Castro's grandson and Raul Castro's son. The president has mused that it's going to be a friendly or maybe not so friendly takeover. But here's my concern, and this may be where you and I have again another area of difference. So at one level, the Venezuela operation has been a success in the sense that Maduro is gone. He's now in New York, where he'll get the ability to defend himself, you know, in front of a jury of his peers and, you know, provide a defense that, you know, was not an option for the people that he imprisoned when he was running Venezuela. So no tears, you know, cried over Maduro. I do worry a little bit, though, about the precedent that's being set here, not just with Maduro, but in Iran as well, of decapitation. You know, there are ways that can come back and haunt us, I worry about. But there's also the fact that we're continuing the extrajudicial execution of drug runners in the Caribbean. There's the question of cui bono. I mean, it's going better, you know, in Venezuela, in the sense that Delcy Rodriguez is working with the administration. She's making deals on oil and deals on minerals. They're having a few, you know, kind of, I would say, mostly, you know, they're having some prisoner releases, but they're mostly, you know, kind of lip service to the broader question of human rights in Venezuela. And the president's telling Maria Corina Machado, don't go back to Venezuela right now, you know. So will we end up in Cuba with a similar kind of operation where some kind of deal gets cut with somebody in the Cuban regime who will open up Cuba, you know, so it can be like in The Godfather, where people go back having casinos in Havana and maybe some, you know, some deals for other, you know, some, I want to get cigar rights, you know, when they reopen some of the cigar factories and privatize them, but that it's going to be kind of insider deals and the regime stays in place. I mean, what's to stop us from ending up there?
So I guess a couple of thoughts. I mean, those are all fair points. No question about that. But I mean, a counter argument would be something like this. That unfortunately, given the number of people who have guns in Venezuela and what sides they're on, a Machado presidency was not going to be in the cards. It just wouldn't. Or if it was, it, you know, she'd be a total figurehead with no power whatsoever. And that what you're better off doing is setting in train a process that may eventually lead you to something better. I mean, I think that's the best case that you can construct. I'm not sure I fully believe that, but it's not unreasonable. Similar thing with Cuba. That, and, you know, which is one I think that Rubio feels most strongly about, because it's pretty clear, I think, that he does not, I don't think Marco Rubio, whose star is in the ascendant, one has to say, whether he has shoes that are two size too big or not.
It's because his shoes are too big.
Yeah. I don't think he's simply interested in, you know, fancy casinos that, you know, mob bosses.
It's personal for Marco. It's not business.
It's right. And there again, I mean, you know, one of the ways in which these kinds of authoritarian regimes crack up is you get sort of authoritarian reformers and it kind of gets beyond them somehow. And you evolve into something better. And that's messy and sloppy, but it has been known to happen.
South Korea, for instance.
Yes. And now here's the other thing. Portugal, I think also, I think you could probably say it was something like that.
But here's another
way to think about that. Think about that in the other direction. If you're in Iran and you see that happening with Cuba, you're saying, you know, maybe we don't have to live in a country where the capital city is going to run out of water, where periodically we have the Israelis and the Americans beating the daylights out of our infrastructure. We can have it. We can still have sovereignty. We can get investment. We can get access to the things we like about the United States. We can get sanctions off our neck if we just get rid of, you know, a particular bunch of guys. Now, Iran is a different case. I fully understand. And maybe this is, you know, maybe this isn't entirely plausible. But you know, I think that's why in a couple of years, you know, you could end up with the anonymous colonel that we've talking about taking charge, and, you know, negotiating a deal where the regime that we hate is still sort of in place, but not entirely in place. And you've set it on a different path. I think that's one of the plausible possibilities we can imagine. Let's hope so.
Well, you know, you've ended this episode of Shield of the Republic on an uncharacteristically upbeat, positive note. So we'll have to leave it there. But obviously, this is a topic to which we will return.
Yeah, we'll be coming back.